Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to our podcast,
Life After the Letters.
I'm Amelie.
And I'm Suba.
We're friends that met whilst working our first shifts as junior doctors.
And we're here to talk about the stories and challenges that we face every day.
This week, I have the pleasure of introducing Thomas Curran. I came across Tom via TEDMED whilst creeping on who their next speakers would be and ended up reading his paper on perfectionism. Tom is a personality and social psychologist, lecturer and assistant professor. He's lectured in Australia and also somewhat of a statistical wizard. He has a special interest in the trait of perfectionism and its effect on mental health. And his theory regarding cultural influences on perfectionism is really interesting. Today, we'll be picking his brains on the topic of perfectionism, why it's at an all-time high, and why it's a negative for our mental health. Welcome to the studio.
Hello, hello.
Thank you for that introduction.
You're very welcome. You've
clearly done your homework.
Yeah, Google tells you a lot.
it absolutely does. Almost too much sometimes.
It's terrifying.
But that's another story.
Yeah, it's dangerous.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you're very welcome, and we're happy to have you on the show. So, you're not actually from London.
Oh, so at the moment, I'm living in Bath, but I am shortly going to be moving into the big city, so it's a big move for me.
Very exciting.
It is very exciting. I'm looking forward to it. Mm-hmm. So, just dipping my toe in today, and a couple of weeks' time, it'll be full on.
He says he's very excited, yeah, but I just spent about 15 minutes with him just chatting about his move to London, and actually I don't think he sounds that excited. But I completely understand where you're coming from. Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about your journey? Did you grow up in Bath, or is that just where you ended up working later on?
No, so I grew up in Northamptonshire.
Okay.
So that's where I'm from, a place called Wellingborough.
Okay.
It's a small town you kind of go through, but don't necessarily stop.
But your family did.
They did. And I soon got out. I did an undergraduate degree in a little college called Bedford. I was going to be a PE teacher, actually.
Yeah,
that was my original aspiration.
Why was that, do you remember?
I just love sport.
Yeah.
I was really, really sporty as a kid. And, I loved football and I loved cycling, so I kind of
just made sense.
And you look at your PE teacher and you're like, they're living their best life.
Absolutely.
So that's what I want to be doing.
Absolutely.
And they were always the cool teacher.
They were, and they wore like polo shirts to school. It was great. It was amazing.
No uniform.
No.
It's just awesome. Had a great lifestyle.
I do have regrets.
Reconsidering things.
Life choices. Yeah, now we're talking about it. Yeah. No. But I kind of got really interested in psychology while I was doing my undergraduate. So.
So what did you study as an undergrad?
I studied sport and exercise science.
Okay.
But a part of that, you do like health and exercise psychology.
Oh yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
Kind of why people engage in health behaviours, motivations, and how barriers facilitators, and how we can get people more healthy. And I was just found that really like fascinating. Mm-hmm. You know, why people are inactive, or why they don't engage in necessarily the healthiest lifestyles, and some of the psychological processes underpinning those things. And that kind of led on to an interest which I kind of developed in my PhD, which was around motivation and physical activity among young people.
Okay.
So I did
Tom looked at us both very pointedly as he said, young people. Thank you.
Yeah.
You guys, we are the youth of today.
You guys are very, very young. I feel very energized in the studio. But I went up. I was really interested in that. I've kind of changed a little bit. I'm sure we'll come on to.
Mm-hmm.
But I did my PhD up in Leeds, and then I did a postdoc in Melbourne.
Cash?
You were all up north, and then you were like, I'll just go to Melbourne.
I know.
I just had enough of the weather.
Yeah.
I just wanted a bit of sun for a year or two. Postdoc there.
So your research in undergrad and before your postdoc, what was that looking at?
Mainly health behaviours among young people. Okay. So motivations that go underneath physical activity in particular.
Can I ask, was that generally young people, or was it more like your athletes that you were looking at then?
It was kids, really, in sports settings, trying, you know, why they engage in sport and why they don't, and how we can keep them there once they're there, because one of the problems, particularly in sport and kids, because it's the biggest... it's the biggest opportunity for physical activity in that cohort, is that you can get them in the system, but then there's a massive drop off after about 14.
Mm.
So it's an interesting problem how you keep them there. And of course, we know if you can keep them there past that point, you'll keep them engaged for life.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was a really interesting topic, important. But as I sort of developed, I kind of become much more interested in the psychology rather than the health, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I became really interested in psychological theories, concepts, and latterly, I did another postdoc in Cheltenham, and then I moved to Bath about 3 years ago. I've focused more mental health, and in particular, perfectionism, which is my area. Yeah.
So what brought that shift? What from the sort of research you were doing beforehand, how did perfectionism sort of rise to the surface as a special interest for you?
Very personal, I think. I'd sort of recognised a lot of perfectionist tendencies in myself. Mm. And I saw a lot of students as well, young people, myself included, people that I interact with and the people that I would teach, would have excessively high standards for themselves and engage in a lot of self-criticism when things don't go well. And it was quite evident to me that this was something that was very unhealthy, and I saw it myself too. And one of the things that jumped out at me in the literature was perfectionism.
Okay.
It's something that very few people have researched, but it was something that I thought anyway that was very, very prevalent. And it just kind of sparked a bit of an interest. So I did a couple of early studies looking at what it predicts, so some of the outcomes. And then as that grew and the interest grew, I decided. I turned my attention more to development, so why it develops in the first place.
Interesting.
And as I say, because I saw it around me, it was interesting to me why that might have been the case today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you look at perfectionism, what is it that you see perfectionism as being? How would you like define it almost?
It's a personality characteristic. So we call it like a surface level trait.
Mm-hmm. Which means...
It means that it's not, so it has some genetic component. Okay. There's around about half of perfectionism that we know is inherited. So classic twin studies show that around about half of the individual differences in perfectionism can be put down to genetics. But the reason why we call it surface level trait is because that leaves a lot to be explained by social factors. And immediate social factors, so the immediate family environment, but also more broader social factors such as the culture that... we grew up in or develop in. So that's why we call it surface level trait, because there's a lot of social stuff going on there, and that was what was really interesting to me.
Yeah. And when you talk about those social factors, what sort of things are we looking at really in our wider environments? I know that's a big question.
it's a huge question. And a lot of the research today has focused on immediate family environment.
Okay.
Because a lot of clinical case reports show that people that present perfectionist tendencies, when you often explore the root of it, there's a lot of early life experiences, early childhood experiences, particularly around parenting practices. But what's also interesting is that parenting practices don't operate in a vacuum. Like, there's a broader cultural context to those behaviours, and there's also a broader cultural context that young people develop into. And what's really interesting from behavioural research is that actually the variance of social personality development with parenting in immediate family context is actually quite small.
Yeah.
And it's actually the broader culture that young people find themselves in that has a much heavier impact on the types of personalities that
they
develop.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is really interesting and quite sort of scary, isn't it? Because actually that's something that we don't have a lot of control over. And that's not something that a lot of us... It's more like you're at the sort of on the receiving end of what the sort of broad cultural context is. So if our culture is telling us that perfectionism is an ideal that we should all be striving to, then that's what our culture is telling us to do. What can you really do about it? Do you know what I mean? So it kind of leaves you at like a at sort of a loss, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the example I often give my students is if you grew up in a family that had a different accent.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad has an Irish accent. Mm. And did you keep that accent? And it's always a case that nobody does, because essentially there's much greater weight of development on even things like accents beyond the immediate family context that have an impact on how we behave and how we interact. And you're absolutely right. Today's culture, there is a heavy emphasis on work ethic, meritocracy.
Absolutely.
And at the heart of that sits perfectionism.
So let's talk a bit about how that's actually really damaging to mental health. I feel like in some ways it seems almost obvious that striving for never-ending perfection is clearly just going to be a road to nowhere. But what sort of, what does the evidence kind of show? What kind of key mental health issues are people more vulnerable to?
So perfectionism, we know what perfectionism predicts. There's a lot of evidence to both in clinical case reports and also in academic literature suggests that perfectionism contributes to a lot of psychological problems. And the reason why it's so problematic is you can kind of think about it like a I discuss this in a lot of the talks I give, but it's a cycle of self-defeat that perfectionists just cannot really step off. So they set themselves high goals, because at the root of perfectionism is a need for other people's approval. And that manifests itself.
We're going to church.
Take a breath.
That's the root of it, right? Like, so that's how it develops, this contingent sense of self-esteem based on how other people see us. And from that, the behaviours that come from it are obviously high achievement, because if I'm perfect, then people will love me, people will like me. And so therefore, that's the goal. But of course, if we're striving for other people's approval, high goals, we're setting ourselves excessive standards. And then we overstrive, so we wear ourselves out to meet them. But of course, the goal's too high in the first place, so we don't meet it, so we're highly critical of ourselves, because that perceived failure reflects badly on ourselves as a person, or we perceive it to reflect badly on ourselves as a person, which leads to a lot of anxiety, worry, rumination, overgeneralization, feelings of incompetence, etc., etc. And then to compensate, we work even harder to try to make up for that perceived deficiency, which in turn leads us to a very, very negative spiral for mental health. So in short, that's why it's so damaging.
Are you feeling triggered, Siva?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm also just thinking, obviously, so from a medical standpoint, it's obviously like there's a cultural pressure to be that way. But how about in scenarios where someone's career or job also demands aspects of perfectionism? Imagine that's a heavier weight as well. And I suppose also when we talk about outcomes, you know, when you talk about the personal cycle, we talk about not feeling comfortable in yourself with your perceived failure. But what if, you know, less than perfect also has sort of tangible consequential outcomes, such as...
Which, of course, it will do.
Yeah, such as patient safety outcomes.
Absolutely.
That's even more stressful to then for someone to move forward, particularly someone who's quite perfectionistic, to then take forward an actual outward failure, so as to speak. And move forward without that being even more damaging for their mental health.
But what I would say to that is, and that's 100, I totally agree, 100%. There are certain jobs in this world where perfection or near perfection is almost criteria.
And I
would say to that a couple of things. The first thing is, I think, like, don't confuse perfectionism with other things that are like meticulousness or conscientiousness or diligence, because the two are different. And perfectionism is not going to contribute to better performance. It's actually going to inhibit performance, because if you're, let's say you're a doctor and you're a perfectionistic about a particular treatment or operation that you're working hard to, you know, almost make sure it's flawless. Mm. If you work so hard that you actually reach a point at which any more effort is going to yield diminishing, if not inverse returns, because you're sacrificing other areas of your life like sleep or healthy diet or friends or whatever stuff, where you can actually let go and relax and be refreshed, you're actually going to inhibit the performance in the actual activity itself. So I would say one, to be careful not to conflate the two, because meticulousness and conscientiousness are very different from perfectionism. But also, even if we take perfectionism as something that, okay, maybe it is necessary for performance, the evidence is weak on that issue, and it's weak because they put in too much effort and they sacrifice other areas
important.
Of life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose a lot of our listeners will listen to this, recognise parts of what we look at the perfectionism culture as something that's inherent to the everyday work that we do. Because I think almost everyone's wanting to succeed at their jobs, do amazing, look great on social media, and they want to do their side hustles. I'm like kind of talking about myself a little bit as well. They want to do their side hustles, make them into businesses, almost because you see everyone else doing that, you think almost, that's the norm. And then also in like the strive of like gaining equality as well, you want to be like, look, I can do absolutely everything.
Yeah.
So I think all these things, which is probably like affecting our generation a little bit more than our parents' generation, for example, will definitely put us into that line of becoming like perfectionists to detriment to other parts of our lives.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work on burnout among young people now, and a lot of stuff that's gone viral around, because that's what we see. And I consider myself to be, you know, not as young as you guys, but still.
I know your age.
Okay.
Can we stop it?
Yeah. But you know what? I do the same thing. I feel like I look at like people in their mid 20s. I'm like, the youth today.
Oh, do you know what I do that with?
Like they're 18.
Yeah. You know, like the junior doctors. They can literally be like maybe 25, 26. I'm like, oh god, baby, look at you. No, come over here. Let me teach you. But they're like literally like we're at the same grade. We do the same job. Yeah. Can you relax, please? Okay.
No, it's funny, isn't it? Like, but I can totally empathise. Like, I can totally see that, because that's kind of my life too. And, you know, I mean, I took myself off all forms of social media.
Oh, I was just going to say we should talk about social media.
Sorry, can you let the man talk, please?
Yeah, sorry.
but going back to your point, like because of the I did feel a lot of pressure to sort of project, even though I don't feel necessarily vulnerable to that kind of...
Yeah.
Those kind of worries, you still feel it, like, because it's everywhere, like, it's and you can't really escape it,
almost shapes your view of what is now a norm.
And that's why we think culture's got a big role to play in, and what our data is showing about rising levels of perfectionism, because of essentially, you know, young people are exposed to images of perfection and curated images of perfection all around them. And they're told that actually, you know, the perfect life and lifestyle is attainable, it's achievable if you just work hard enough, if you put in enough effort.
If you get the right opportunity.
If you put yourself in the right place, if you hustle, right? Yeah. Like, these are the messages that we're sent. Yes. So is it any wonder that we're seeing these behaviours, you know, people engaging in these activities, working really, really hard because this is what they're told, and as a consequence, burning out. And perhaps sitting underneath that is perfectionism. I think what we need to be a little bit careful about is actually whether those promises are indeed true.
Absolutely.
Like, that's to say that we're told this, but is it necessarily today the case, particularly young people that I teach, 18, 19, 20, is it necessarily the case that if you put all this hard work in, you put all this stuff on your CV, that you're going to get this kick-ass job at the end of it? Is that promise now today really realistic? I don't know. I'm not sure.
Absolutely.
Given the way, you know, the economy's changed and the jobs have changed. So I think we need to be a bit careful about that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what's actually funny? I think when I look back at our first year of work, so I was living with Suba then. We were living in Essex. And so I'd just come back from Manchester and I was doing like a lot of work with Nike at the time. So I was so excited to be so close to London to be able to go and work with them. I remember taking a day off work one day. And going in, doing some like work with Nike. I thought I was flexing a little bit. I was posting it on the gram. I was like, going to meetings. But then at the end of that day, I didn't actually get paid by Nike, even though they might have given me a bunch of clothes. I didn't really get paid by them, but I was flexing like I was doing everything. And then what I would do, so then the next day, I did a locum shift at my work. And actually, I got paid so much more from, like, so much from my locum shift.
Yeah.
Just, like, getting my head down, going to work, doing a job that I enjoyed.
Yeah.
No one saw it on social media. I don't even post, like, my workplace often on social media.
Mm.
And actually, like, the monetary gains that I got were so much bigger from just going to work, having an enjoyable day, rather than having, like, such a high-stress day that I was able to flex everywhere. Yeah. But it's not something that you almost correlate at the time as being more successful. So I thought the Nike thing was way more successful.
Yeah.
But actually just doing my day to day was more successful at that moment in time.
But that's sort of about the social gains almost, isn't it? Because for someone that's looking at your your feed or looking at your story is gonna be
the optics are different.
Oh yeah, exactly. He's gonna be so much more impressed by this like day with Nike than about you being like, I did a locum shift.
People are gonna be like, okay, but also that's internal for me as well. So I thought it was amazing that I was sitting in certain meetings and doing certain projects, but actually it hasn't really done much for my career or anything like going forward.
Yeah.
It's my day-to-day work that has done that for me and brought me to even do this podcast. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So LOLs, optics aren't everything.
No, that's so true. And I kind of want to talk about social media because I think this is really interesting. Because I think social media is actually amazing and an excellent vehicle for change and giving like the mouthpiece to the people. In a sense, and lots of people
democratizing the voice.
Yeah, tell them. Like, you know, it's people get to sort of talk about what they want to talk about, and you can go to different accounts that kind of have different messages rather than having to rely on like traditional sort of media sources, which I think is awesome. But also, obviously, on the flip side, a lot of social media is just like beautiful people that somehow are rich but also don't work or like have traditional jobs and like are living their best lives 24/7. And it's one of those things that I always worry about, like my younger cousins who grew up with social media and sometimes can't differentiate between being able to look at like images of things and being able to actually tease out the reality of those things. Like, do you know what I mean? I think it's maybe sometimes, like you most mentioned, for the more vulnerable people, like be able to kind of differentiate the two, that can kind of get sucked into the thinking that this is actually an attainable and achievable reality, and then use that as a comparison for themselves and often end up feeling let down by it. But also you see a lot of social media personalities actually nowadays, there's a big push to kind of be a lot more real, hashtag real, on social media and kind of talk
hashtag
about
sponsored
but to talk about sort of, you know, like unedited images or sort of more realistic day-to-day aspects of their life, because actually, you know, like all we really all want as human beings is like connection with each other, and social media is another tool for that. And a lot of people react quite well to seeing someone be more realistic or more honest or more truthful about what's going on in their life and what you're actually seeing. So I suppose that's kind of where, with regard to the cultural pressures on perfectionism, that's kind of an area where we could all sort of try and make cultural shifts, right? Because if we can all be more honest with whoever we're sharing with on social media about what's actually going on with our lives or what we actually want to talk about, then, you know, hopefully that's something that can kind of undermine this constant drive for perfectionism.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely, I think that's a great analysis of where social media is right now. I'm with you 100%. I think social media is a very positive force. It can bring people around shared interests and goals. It can essentially break or start to break down traditional forms of media and how media is typically disseminated, and give a voice back to people that feel for a long time they've been disenfranchised. So I think on all of those points, social media is a very good thing. I think we miss the point really when we ask the question, is social media good or bad? Like, we miss the point, because a lot of the risk, and even as researchers we do that, because we look at aggregate time on screen and go, is it correlated with well-being? But the question is much more nuanced than that.
Absolutely.
It's great for some people, And it's really, really problematic for others based on underlying vulnerabilities.
Absolutely.
And what's worrying for me is that we know, one, from our own research, that one vulnerability is perfectionism. We know perfectionism is on the rise among young people. So it's not that social media itself is bad. It's that if you bring underlying vulnerabilities to the table and you use it for the wrong reasons, I have to say that short-term hit for likes or followers that's very transient, and then of course you have the level now, the benchmark that you need to hit for the next photo that you share. Can you see this is an exhausting process for some people who are doing it for the wrong reasons. And so I feel for me that's where I am with social media, and I think we just need to be very careful about throwing the baby out of the bathwater, because I think it's a great thing, but there are certain aspects of it that can trigger certain individuals with underlying vulnerabilities, and one of them is perfectionism.
Okay. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And so we've spoken almost a little bit about the culture. How as an individual can you almost see those traits of perfectionism in yourself? How do you become more aware of it, if that makes sense?
I kind of goes back to Suva's point about a counterculture, right? Like, I think things are going to get worse. I mean, I don't want to be like optimistic straight away, because I think things are going to get worse. I think we're seeing, particularly Facebook, there's a new innovation where you can like face tune or your face or something. It's just like, this is the most horrible.
I don't know how new that is.
Maybe you are older than us, because like, it's not that new.
Oh, is that not new?
No, okay.
I heard about this the other day. I was like, are you kidding me? This thing is, I'm off Facebook, so I have no idea what's going on. But it's like, so all these things that come through, then they instantly make me feel more depressed. But then I see young people every day.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, you guys are totally like counterculturing this, like, you know, there is this kind of real movement, body positivity. I love the work of Natasha Devon, who does a lot of positive advocacy in this area, and there's a lot of traction being built in that space, and I feel like there's good reason to be optimistic. So I feel like there is good reason to be optimistic, and that's how it's got to start. You know, it has to start from the bottom up. That, you know, we can talk about policies and we can talk about things that we can do at a governmental level, but actually, without young people themselves saying no, this culture is not serving us as well, and we want to challenge it and do something about it, then things don't change. But I think we are beginning to see that, and as individuals and as collectives, we are sort of rejecting this idea that we need to be perfect, that we need to be flawless, that we need to have a perfect life or lifestyle, we need to have the car, we need to have the house, you know, these kind of very materialistic things. I think we are moving away from, and I think that's a very positive thing.
And do you ever, I'm not sure, with your research, have you looked at perfectionism in the workplace and what that looks like for particularly like a lot of our listeners, once again, who work in like law firms or corporate firms or work in the hospital or general practices?
Yeah, I think young almost, professionals in general.
Yeah, essentially, and particularly those who live in London, I think so much of what we've done and the way that our parents may have raised us has been to
strive.
You said that for so much.
So much exhaustion.
Yeah. It's to keep striving. And we've been doing that since our A-levels to university, yeah, to postgraduate, to the work that we do now. How is it that, how can we shift the culture, or do you see culture shifting in the workplace?
That's a more tricky one. Okay. But it's a very good question, because there's...
Why is it more tricky?
Because that's a harder one to shift. There are broader, I mean, you know, I won't bore you with the historical context, but the way that economies have changed in the last 30 years has been substantial, and the way that companies operate within that culture is very, very different. There's a lot more precarity, there's a lot more insecurity, and companies are, you know, expecting longer hours for the same pay. And this has kind of been the story now for the last 10 years. Wages have not really gone anywhere, and you know more better than I do about how that culture plays out within the health context and the NHS in terms of much more pressurized environments, increasing population, meaning more workload, but for the same amount of expected hours. And so it's putting pressure on everybody, and we're seeing a lot of pressure in the workplace. And a lot of work-related stress, absenteeism, et cetera, that's on the rise. And one of the things that we've done in the area of perfectionism is show that if you're a perfectionist in that context, it's particularly damaging. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting is that it's in the workplace where perfectionism has its strongest correlations with burnout.
Yeah.
Because you can't extricate yourself from that environment. You're there, you have to work within those confines and that context. And when you perceive a lack of control, it becomes very, very exhausting if you're a perfectionist. So, that's where I think it would be much more difficult to change. And I think that's where, again, I'm less optimistic on that one.
That's interesting you say that, because actually when you were saying that's when it'll become more difficult for people, just because that's when they start to drop out or they've become burnt out. So we were looking at this topic of burnout with our last guest last week. And essentially what he was saying is that actually we can use that as a tool for change.
Yeah.
So I suppose it's different in the NHS because obviously it's government funded, and they essentially need to retain the doctors that they're training in this country. Suba, who's going to New Zealand next week. Or was it this week?
This week.
That's crazy. Tomorrow. Oh, I'm actually so excited for you too. I wish I could come as well, but...
Yeah, I'm super jealous.
I can't wait.
So I think it's interesting that the government needs to do like a little bit more work retaining us, and maybe that's a positive thing for them to see how they can retain their workers by treating them better, by expecting a little bit less in terms of like hours, and also just rewarding people either monetarily or with time in lieu and things like that. So actually I saw that as a positive. I suppose you can only do that when you're talking about a big group of people rather than smaller businesses.
I mean, I can go political on this.
Go on, go on, please.
Well, you got to understand, the worst civil servant is the best civil servant, according to conservative ideology. Mm-hmm. Because if a national health service works, if a nationalised and socialised education system works, and they haven't got an argument. Mm. Like they don't, the idea that government doesn't function, well, it relies on government not functioning. So, for the health service, as long as you have a sort of conservative government, I think it would be difficult to make the argument for the positive things to change, like the working conditions, the pay, etc., because of where they come from ideologically. I think particularly in the health service, that's created a lot of issues among the workforce, just because of, you can't have an increase in population and an increased demand on a service and not at the same time give it the funding that it requires.
So hypothetically speaking, you're saying that they'd be more inclined, not the Conservative Party specifically, but are you saying that governments could be more inclined to shift towards like a private system, or are you saying that they'd be more inclined just to make people work harder and more often?
It just depends where you come
on
from.
On good grace, maybe.
It just depends where you come from on that. Like if you come from a perspective that there's a role of the state to move into an area where the market wouldn't necessarily effectively function, i.e. health, education, things that haven't necessarily got the profit motive, then that leads the way for more sort of progressive policy making that would fund it. You know, and Australia's got a good system. New Zealand's got a good system. You know, it's kind of mostly state, but there's a bit of private, and it kind of works quite well. So I'm not saying it has to be the NHS, but the point is that certainly isn't the perspective, from what I can see anyway, of the Conservative Party in this country, who have really, in my opinion, anyway, of sort of there's a dereliction of duty in terms of funding for the NHS, which requires far, far more funding than is available. And that has knock-on impacts on staffing. And it's no wonder that many, many doctors move abroad, because there are better conditions and there's better pay. And I was in Australia for my postdoc, and I met loads of doctors from the United Kingdom who were having a great time because it was just so much better to work there.
Yeah.
So I think we do need to help and build better working conditions, because it is important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Suba, you in New Zealand, how did you find the working conditions differ?
Well, this is the thing, actually. People always ask me, they're like, so did you do so much less work in New Zealand? And I'm like, no, it's the job does not vary that much. It's
the patients are the same.
It's just as busy, it's just as chaotic, and your hours are the same. You know, I feel like sometimes the way you see it is that your hours are fixed, right? So if they have 10 hours of your time, they've got 10 hours of your time. Mm-hmm. Until the 10 hours are done, like, you just have to work.
So you're not surfing within those 10 hours?
No, yeah, you're not sat around, like, you know, frolicking on the beaches or, yeah, that's not happening. But the few things that actually do make a big difference and make you feel like a valued employee are the fact that you get free food. And I know that sounds so simple and so basic, but it was a huge deal for all of us British docs over there. We could not get over it. Like, still sort of 5 months down the line, we were like, oh my God, it's free. Like, it's such a little thing for an employer to actually provide, but it sort of makes you, it takes a huge stress off you, firstly. You don't have to worry about getting your lunch ready the day before or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes a bit of, frees up a bit of your time, but also you just feel like a bit more valued by your employer. And then the second thing was just that overall staff morale was better. And those two things are probably the biggest things that made it more enjoyable for me. Mm-hmm. People that I was working with generally being quite happy and relatively upbeat and quite happy to be there. So whereas sometimes I think when you're working in the NHS, the general mood is a bit...
That's not always the priority.
Yeah, it's, and I think that brings it back a bit,
to what you guys were both saying in the first place. Mm. Actually, with perfectionism, it can never just be a purely good thing. And actually, we shouldn't conflate it with those like specific, useful traits. So when you look at them focusing on making sure that you guys are well fed, they're actually looking to make sure that you're well rested. They're making sure that you're having some time out to rest and relax or to commune with your colleagues.
Yeah.
So actually, there's also a focus on those positive things that you might lose if you were just to work and become tired or become burnt out or work so much that you do fall off that cliff that you were describing earlier.
It would be interesting, actually.
Let's do a study.
To know how bad burnout rates are in different places and what things sort of affect.
It's being valued, though, right? Like, that's kind of it's a gesture from the service that, you know, we value you, and therefore don't worry about picking up the tab for, like, things like lunches or whatever. Like, it's a very small gesture, and I'm sure it doesn't cost that much. But
it goes a long way.
But I guess in terms of staff morale and absenteeism and that sort of stuff, I'm sure it saves loads and loads.
100%. And I think morale is a huge thing, because I think, like, you know, we all as people can probably manage and cope with quite a lot. Like, you can sort of take quite a lot before you sort of say, actually, I've really had enough. And what you want to do is not let anyone get to that point where they can turn around and say, actually, I've really had enough, because it takes a lot. Like, and it doesn't take much to sort of limit it getting to that point. So this is why it seems like such a waste when you have people that, you know, sort of strip out of the career because of burnout, because it's like they've taken so much. Like, they were willing to take so much.
It's so funny, it takes a lot until it doesn't take anything at all. It could just be the next morning someone's like, nah, you can't. So,
not
you know
anymore.
If you go around, you're like, okay, has anyone got a spare pen? And then everyone has a spare pen, then you're like, do you know what, effort, that's it, I'm done, out of here. But it's funny, those things really build up until you can't tolerate anything.
Or just like one small criticism. I can imagine it would be like one day someone's oh, your skirt's a bit short, and you're like, bye.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm done.
Or you know when they say,
length,
sorry,
Sharon.
I've got so many, you know, and they're like, can you just take that necklace off? And I'm like,
why?
All right, bye. I'm done. Because these things make no sense.
Absolutely. So, I think it's crazy that, like, whilst working at some jobs in the NHS, I would have worked 4 months in a department And by the end, no one still knows my name. And I'm sorry, but it's a name. Like, it's not that hard.
It's not that hard. 4 months.
And then, yeah, thank you. And like, someone's like, Sue. And I'm like, Suba. It's Suba. I'm sorry, it's Suba. Literally, I've been here 4 months. Why don't you know my name? Whereas in New Zealand, it's crazy, but I would be on an on-call shift on a ward that I don't even work on. And some of the nurses would be like, oh, what's your name, doctor? And I'm like, you want to know my name? I'm just
like, you want to know it, guys.
You want to know my name? And I would just like never leave their ward and do all the jobs they want me to do. It just takes so little, doesn't it?
It does.
You're so worn down by the system sometimes.
No, it's so and it's funny what the culture does to your mind. So I remember I asked a nurse what her name was. And then she was like, yeah, what do you want? And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm literally just asking your name. And then she was like, blah, blah, blah. And then I was like, oh, okay, cool, nice to meet you. And then I walked away and she must have been stunned.
She was shook. She probably thought about that for the next 7 days. Like, why did she want my name? Yeah. Like, is she committing some kind of identity fraud? Like, what is she doing?
Oh, gosh. But I suppose that's where we need to, like, shift our focus at work from, like, looking at ourselves as individuals who have full needs rather than, okay, we're just here to get this stuff done for this organisation that doesn't really care about us all the time.
Yeah, yeah, that's the thing, because there's little ways in which I guess we can all protect ourselves and contribute to our culture. But it's like you said, it's really hard at work because it's kind of beyond you almost, you know. It's sort of something that sometimes does really need to come from top down and not only sort of bottom up.
What I'd be interested to like know is, within the people that you work with, are you quite good at recognizing perfectionism and the dangers of that within your own team, because you're all obviously all quite aware of what that looks like?
Yeah, I mean, academics are notorious for moaning about work-life balance, but it's all self-inflicted. Like, we work as hard as we do because we love what we do. Mm. We, you know, and universities do take advantage of that a little bit, I think. But one of my major roles at the university is pastoral role to students. Mm. And I see a lot of perfectionist tendencies among staff, but I see more among students. And I think for me anyway, it's about recognizing when people are putting too much pressure on themselves, particularly students around exam times, around coursework submissions. This tends to where we see a lot of the problems start to arise, and recognizing when the standards are too excessive, and signposting them in the direction of professional mental health support, because talking to someone's really, really important. And sometimes it's just like rationalizing that, you know what, it's not the end of the world, that you might have had a bad grade on this occasion, but actually there's a bigger picture. And sometimes it's really we lose the wood for the trees in focusing on the minutiae when realizing that there's a broader goal that we all need to work towards, whether we want to be a teacher or a doctor or whatever. And that all of these setbacks are just opportunities to learn, right, and develop and grow, and don't necessarily get too bogged down in the score and the grade and the percentage or whatever, and think more about, okay, how can I use this to make sure that I'm better next time?
Absolutely.
So that's kind of some of the things that I'll often communicate to students when they come to me in a bit of distress around having not achieved their high standards.
Yeah. And I think you summed up really clearly in your article in the Harvard Business Review. Big ups.
Available from all good airports.
And there were two titles I liked, like the two subsections that I really liked in the article. So one was going on that, and it was talking about how perfection isn't always the best goal, or I can't remember what it said. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know.
You were saying perfection wasn't the only goal that we should be trying to attain. And then there was another one that I love, and I feel like you see in like little bits on like Instagram and stuff, but you said done is better than perfect. I think that speaks to me so much, because there's such a tendency to procrastinate or to think, what is the best solution, what is the best starting point, when actually if you just go out, get stuff done, start your podcast in Suba's bedroom upstairs, then actually you'll be on the journey to getting your goals like achieved, and they might just be more satisfying for you.
This is why perfectionism and procrastination go hand in hand.
Yeah.
Right? Because perfectionists have an aversion to failure. right? They feel failure is an indictment on themselves as a person, right? It shows off some inner weakness or the perceived inner weakness to others. So you can't fail at something you don't start.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why procrastination is such a problem among these individuals. And you're absolutely right. Just get something started. If you've got an idea, go for
it. Yeah.
Don't worry about what the output is. It's probably going to be it. No, I guarantee you it will be rubbish like the first time you do it. Like that's the whole point about starting something new. It's never going to be, you're never going to start as a polished article, but you're absolutely right. Get words on a paper, get yourselves in a bedroom and just start recording. Don't hold back. Never hold back. Just get whatever it is that you're passionate about, whatever it is you want to do. Don't let your perfectionism tell you that if I start this, I'm going to fail, and therefore if I fail, I'm going to look weak, and if I look weak, that's showing off some deficiencies to others. Don't worry. No, it's much more satisfying, as you say, to just start something, get it done, learn, and as you progress and develop, that's where, you know, you actually, and it helps you break down your perfectionism too.
Absolutely. And I think it also allows you to focus on slightly more important goals.
Yeah.
So of like learning and having understanding of certain areas or certain skill sets, rather than just thinking, okay, it's going to be me on a grandstand or on stage one day giving up my Oscar speech. Like that's not the goal. Actually, it's the learning and the enjoyment and the relationships that you build along the way.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's cool.
Yeah. 100%. Something that you touched on in your paper, which I thought was interesting.
Which paper are you talking about?
The study with the college students.
Sure, yeah.
So the original study that showed that there were high rates of perfectionism throughout time.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Something that you spoke about in the introduction section was about sort of people being less, or showing less sort of empathy towards people that were failing, and sort of qualities like that which are encouraged by sort of meritocracy and constantly trying to be the best or trying to get the top grades and things like that means that you sort of don't consider people that don't do as well with as much empathy, or if something goes wrong, you're more likely to blame it on them than you are to accept your own blame. And is that something that you see? I mean, because I think it's also interesting that you obviously have young students that you teach and that you provide pastoral care for. Is that something that you do see in your student cohort as well?
Well, this is, in today's culture, you're told anyway that you're the captains of our own destiny, right? So like, it's up to you. You know, it's all on you. You have it within your you know, power to do whatever you want, as long as you try hard enough. This is kind of the ethos behind meritocracy. And with that comes a very individualistic mindset. That's to say that we kind of internalize a sense that we're all individuals. There's a classic Thatcher line that we're all individuals now, there's no such thing as society or whatever, and that actually we just need to look after ourselves first and foremost. And the theory goes, of course, that if we're all self-interested actors in a free and fair marketplace, then it's the best way to organise. Everybody prospers, a rising tide lifts all boats, yada yada yada. And so that's, and that.
So you sound like my A-level politics teacher. It's so funny.
Like, but that's where this comes from, right? That's where this sense that okay, so I'm my own. This is why the hustle comes in. I'm my own entrepreneur, and I make my, you know, I can make my own way in life. And this is where we start to see a lot of competitiveness come in, because we're constantly vigilant about where we sit in society. And that leads us to spending behaviors and patterns that are very different to maybe previous generations, something like image goods, status goods, possessions, etc., etc., to demonstrate some form of material worth. So that in that context, you see a lot of these behaviors around less empathy among recent generations of young people, more individualistic kind of traits, so extroversion, self-esteem movement. We could go into that, like, you know, it's you know, you've got to just, as long as you've got high self-esteem, like building up people's self-esteem has become like a bit of a training focus. So it's all around. Young people are seen or bombarded with just norms. It's all about themselves, and they've got no one to blame but themselves. So that's great if you can do well. Like, if you can succeed, I guess meritocracy works. And that's why those that have done very well are very in favour of meritocracy, because it's kind of a very self-serving doctrine that says, I've done well because of my abilities and my skills. But what we forget about in that conversation is for those that haven't made it.
Yeah.
That because it teaches them that actually your lack of a car or a nice house or a nice job is your own fault, right? Like, and it speaks to your lack of abilities or skills or whatever. And to those people, that's a very, very psychologically damaging a culture to live in.
Absolutely.
And I think that's one of the reasons why we potentially see quite a lot of struggle, because no one wants to end up there. No one wants to feel flawed. We know, we all want to feel competent. We all have a need for purpose and competence. So nobody wants to end up there. So that's why we have this kind of incessant need to, as individuals, strive, achieve, perform, because in this culture, that's how we get our self-worth.
And I know we've not come here to talk about like male suicide at all today, but I just remember back to my time when I was doing a psychiatry placement, and a father of a young man who'd committed suicide, he came to talk to us about the certain things that we could look out in, our patients, but even more importantly, also our family and friends. And I think like one of the number one risk factors for men to commit suicide, and women as well, is if someone within your family has committed suicide, so now that becomes an option. But then he also looked at a whole list of different factors. And what I thought was so interesting was actually there's lots of people who would seemingly look very successful, seemingly look very competent, who are also dealing with high levels of anxiety and high levels of what their reality not matching up to that figure or, and dream that they have in their head. So he just said, look, it's not always the people who are, it's not always the people who are underachieving. And a lot of times it just frankly isn't. And we need to think about what anxiety looks like, particularly in young men.
Definitely. I think what you touched on there is so interesting, because it's about this, I know it's not American in our case, but almost like this American dream of success as being something that's sold to us as like the pinnacle of what we should all aspire for. But that for very many of us, you may get there and not feel fulfilled at all, because it's not actually something that's your own concept of what success or a dream is. And even the concept of success is all relative, right? Because is it you having sort of more figures in your bank account than someone else? Is it you having
flexing some clout?
It you having some free Nikes? Like, what is what
all right
is success?
All right, watch it.
Like, what is success, you know? And it's interesting, but also there's like huge countercultures to that, right? Like the whole uprising of like the power of introverts, or like you know, people 100%. That reject the concept of having, like, I'm obsessed with tiny houses. I don't know if you guys have heard
I love tiny houses.
I'm literally obsessed. There's this YouTube channel that I just can't stop watching. But like, you know, even that whole concept of like minimalism, of downsizing, of having a small eco footprint, like things like that. It's a whole counterculture to the actual American dream of having like literally a Hummer. How ridiculous is that? But you're driving around in like a actual army car, but on your road, it's insane. But that's kind of what you see as being like sold as the pinnacle of success in our sort of culture.
But almost when you think about it, when you look at any of these like countercultures or even like the main culture itself, the damaging thing is when you think that that culture itself is specifically going to cater for you and it's going to give you all of your heart's desires.
Yeah.
Look, we always talk about identity at the end of each show, Suba, don't we?
It always comes down to it.
But I think it's so important to figure out what our identity is steeped in.
Yeah.
And if actually it's steeped in, like, image, at, or if it's steeped in the fact that, like, I'm better, like, humanist or socialist than you. Or I have a tiny house and I live this minimal lifestyle.
I'm Mary Kondo.
She is a pinnacle. Let's not joke about this. But I think once you lose your identity in any of those things, it's, everything's fallible at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And it's actually about your happiness and what you feel.
Yeah, just having awareness at the end of the day, isn't it? Being conscious of what's going on.
Yeah,
and that, like, not falling into the narrative traps of, like, a culture.
So easy to, though.
It is easy to. And sometimes that's for you, you know? If you have a aspiration for a family, kids, whatever, that's awesome and that's brilliant. But some people, that's not for everyone, like you were saying. Some people have different goals, and it's about, you know, authenticity is big, and being who you are, you know, you be you.
I mean,
that's a really nice,
like, I love that we're ending this on loads of like positive tips
that you can also find on Instagram.
Live your most authentic life.
Exactly.
Not your best. It may not be the best, but actually it'll be the best for you. There we go.
Maybe we can put that on a Photoshop or something, and maybe
We'll start a print. We'll start a prints business.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's gonna be our new thing.
Put it on a t-shirt. Yeah. Yeah.
Phone cases, everything.
Yeah. Oh gosh.
Okay, well, that's what brings us to a wrap.
It does, but can I just ask you, because I'm just interested in some of the work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. So obviously you're making a move to London. Yes. Dum, 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 dum. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit? He's not, I don't know why he's pretending to be excited. I'm joking.
I was actually going to say, Tom, like getting the tube this morning, I've not done a morning rush hour tube in ages.
It's so rubbish.
And I was like, do you actually want to do this? I'm sure life is a lot better down in Bath.
Oh, it's totally sleepy. Like, yeah. But then again, that has its own issues. But no, it's going to be a shock, but I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be great. Yeah.
And so what sort of things do you have planned in London
in the future?
Well, like I would like our work to go more into awareness. So that's why coming to London really is more opportunity to get close to policymakers. Just build a kind of. I would like if there's one thing I'd like to do is to tell young people that actually, you know, you might think perfectionism is a very positive trait and it's like a necessary evil. Like it's kind of everyone's favorite flaw in a way, right? Like I'm a total perfectionist, right? You hear that?
at the end of every interview. Yes. Yeah. Actually,
what's
funny
worst
story?
Quality? Yeah. I'm such a perfectionist.
But actually, there's a serious point because that's not healthy. And so we're doing a lot of work to develop some awareness, building some awareness among young people about what perfectionism is, what it isn't, and what perhaps better ways to strive and healthier ways to strive, because you'll feel more content both in yourself, but you'll also be far better as a, you know, a rounded person that integrates well, that has good relationships. And because perfectionism has a worldview that separates us, and I think bringing people to get together is really important. So awareness for me is really important. So that's really like the key focus, I think, in the next few years, getting the message out there. Yeah.
So where will you be? Are you going to be working at university? Did you say?
I'm moving to the LSE.
Ah, okay.
Right in there.
Another perfectionist institution. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sue, but also for joining me this morning.
For getting out of bed eventually.
So, yeah. Thank you so much, guys, for listening. Take care. Bye.
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 Catch us over on www.afterthelettersdotcom /aftertheletterson every social media network.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.